The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The rules are set, and today, opening arguments in the Senate's impeachment trial, Democrats took the floor invoking history.
Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States, has acted precisely as Hamilton and his contemporaries feared.
The latest on the impeachment trial of the president. Also, the Auschwitz concentration camp was liberated nearly 75 years ago. As world leaders gather to mark the occasion, Poland says Russia is turning a solemn occasion political.
Just giving Mr. Putin a stage to be heard with this propaganda.
And we remember the man who served up this.
Spam, 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 agent spam!
The brilliant absurdity of Monty Python's Terry Jones. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. On Capitol Hill today, the impeachment trial proceedings began with a prayerful reminder from the Senate chaplain.
Help them remember that patriots reside on both sides of the aisle, that words have consequences, and that how something is said can be as important as what is said.
President Trump is facing two articles of impeachment, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Today, it's the Democrats' turn to present the case for removing Donald Trump from office. Representative Adam Schiff, the lead impeachment manager, kicked things off.
When a man, unprincipled in private life, desperate in his fortune, bold in his temper, possessed of considerable talents, having the advantage of military habits, despotic in his ordinary demeanor, known to have scoffed in private at the principles of liberty, when such a man is seen to mount the hobby horse of popularity,
that's
to join in the cry of danger
Schiff, quoting
liberty,
Alexander Hamilton there, in a letter Hamilton wrote to George Washington. It was a warning about the type of leader who might turn the nation away from democracy and toward monarchy. Joining me now is The World senior editor, Jason Margolis, who's been following the trial in the Senate. What is going on today, Jason?
Well, Marco, as you said, today was the Democrats' turn, and there are seven Democrats called House managers to make the case. They're essentially courtroom lawyers. Among them is Adam Schiff, who spent the afternoon laying out the basics of the case for impeachment. He also used a fair amount of lofty rhetoric, like citing Alexander Hamilton, and he's imploring senators to do their duty. But remember, the audience isn't just the Senate, but it's also the American people watching at home. And Schiff reminded all of us how President Trump withheld aid to Ukraine for political favors. He said the president put his own interests above the interests of the nation.
Did we learn anything new today?
Well, if you watched the House hearings in December, I would say no. Today was basically a recap of what we learned during the impeachment proceedings in the House. It was a bit like watching a movie for the second time. It's a complicated movie with lots of plot twists, and you understand it better on the second viewing, but it's ultimately still the same movie. Schiff said over the next few days, Democrats will present the evidence, which includes testimony from public servants that we heard in the House. But he also said you'll hear from some new speakers.
You will hear from witnesses who have not yet testified, like John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, Mr. Blair and Mr. Duffy. And if you can believe the president's words last month, you will also hear from Secretary Pompeo. You will hear their testimony at the same time as the American people. That is, if you allow it.
If you allow it.
Right. That's the case that Schiff is making. He's saying, if you allow it, if you allow a fair trial.
And Jason, what's going to be the Republican argument in the Senate?
Well, we will hear from the president's lawyers next week. And their argument essentially is Mr. Trump can't be impeached for behaviors that are not actual crimes. This new narrative kind of gives cover to any moderate Republicans who may not like what the evidence already shows, but it's saying maybe the president did these things, but it's not a crime. A lot of constitutional scholars are weighing in, and they say this argument is pretty weak. They say the central question should be, did the president abuse his power?
Remind us where the president is during all of this.
The president is in Davos, Switzerland today, and he weighed in.
I had a very innocent conversation with a very fine gentleman from the Ukraine, and it was based on that. People don't even want to talk about the conversation. I got to watch glimpses in between all of these meetings that I just told you about. I got to watch glimpses of what is taking place, wasting time in Washington.
Yeah, so he essentially repeated what he's always saying. It's a waste of time. It's a hoax. And for good measure, the president also called House managers Gerald Nadler of New York a sleazebag and Adam Schiff a con job.
So what's next? Lay out for us what we should expect.
The Democrats have the floor for the next 24 hours, split over 3 days, so they have the rest of the week. Then Trump's lawyers will get their turn, and finally, senators will be allowed to ask questions of both sides, and they can decide if they want to hear more evidence at that point.
The World's Jason Margolis, thanks very much for the update.
You are welcome.
Turning now to northern Syria, where a major government offensive has sent thousands of people fleeing towards the Turkish border. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is determined to take back the province of Idlib. After nearly 9 years of civil war, this is the last remaining rebel stronghold in Syria. Assad is doing that with the help of his allies, Russia and Iran. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Syrian and Russian warplanes are back in the skies of Idlib, carrying out a fierce airstrike campaign. Their mission is to drive out rebel forces opposed to the Syrian government. Last week, Russia and Turkey brokered a ceasefire, but it didn't last, and the war is back on. Idlib is home to about 3 million people. For them, the fighting has had devastating consequences. Syrian journalists say entire families have been killed. The United Nations estimates that around 350,000 people are on the run as a result of the airstrikes. One of them is 29-year-old Mohammed Al-Qasoum. I first spoke with Al-Qasoum over a scratchy WhatsApp call back in December when the bombing started. He told me he was determined to stay in his home. It was all he had, he said. Then, just a day later, Al-Qasoum messaged to say he's changed his mind. He feared for his life and he was leaving. From Idlib, Al-Qasoum went to Aleppo, a city about an hour to the north. Soon after he got there, he found out that his home had been destroyed. Thankfully, he had sent away the 6 orphans he was taking care of. They reunited in Aleppo, waiting for things to calm down. But things didn't calm down. The bombings followed Al-Qasoum to Aleppo.
After 1 month in western Aleppo, now I have been displaced to northern Aleppo. The same reason. Always the bombing from Assad and Russia.
When I checked in with Al-Qasoum yesterday, he told me he was on the move again, this time heading to northern Aleppo. But getting there wasn't easy.
Some people there tried to kidnap me.
He fled on his motorbike, he says. And when he was on the road, 3 men tried to kidnap him. He managed to fend them off, but when that was over, he had to deal with another danger, the winter weather.
The most difficult thing in this road was the cold. I was really freezing.
Now Al-Qasoum is in northern Aleppo. He and the 6 children are crammed in a rented house.
2 rooms for 21 persons.
2 rooms for 21 people, he says. Al-Qasoum's story is one of thousands. Dr. Zahir Sahloul is the president of Med Global, an NGO that sends medical teams to disaster areas and provides health care for refugees. Sahloul visited northern Syria earlier this month.
I visited some of the temporary shelters.
Sahloul says most humanitarian organizations have left northern Syria. The fighting has made it too dangerous for them to operate, so people have to manage on their own.
They don't have diesel fuel and they don't have wood, so they're using plastic bags, they're using slippers, old shoes to burn, and these are carcinogens. But people have to be warm, especially children.
Sahloul brought along some donations with him, but he says it's not nearly enough. He says the international community has stopped paying attention to what's going on in Syria. There are so many other disasters that grab headlines, like the fires in Australia.
There was outpouring of sympathy to the koalas. And koalas are cute, and we have to take care of them. We have to save their lives. But Syrian children are cute also, and we have to pay attention to them and save their lives.
There is one more observation that Sahloul made on his recent trip to Syria, that despite all the challenges, Syrians have not lost hope. He sent me a video of one of his visits to a makeshift camp. It's nighttime. He and a group of kids are standing around a fire. They're singing about their love for their homeland. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Even the owner of Amazon and the richest man in the world is vulnerable. Hackers broke into the cell phone of Jeff Bezos sometime in 2018. Now a consulting firm hired by Bezos is pointing the finger at Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Bezos, you'll recall, is the owner of the Washington Post, which has been critical of the Saudi government. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou has been following the story.
In May of 2018, Jeff Bezos got a message from a WhatsApp account that apparently belongs to Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known. This was shortly after the two of them had met. MBS was visiting the U.S. They had dinner in Los Angeles. They exchanged numbers. So Jeff Bezos gets this WhatsApp message that contains a video file. It's not clear if Bezos even opened that video, but it appears that that file contained advanced spyware that allowed the hackers to get a lot of data from his phone and also surveil him. You might remember last year, Bezos and his team actually came out and said that they believed that Saudi Arabia had accessed his phone and had gained private information about him. This was after details about an extramarital affair he had were published in a U.S. tabloid. But the information we're learning today implicates MBS directly for the first time.
And where is all this information coming from? Who discovered the hack?
It comes from a company called FTI Consulting that did this forensics investigation on behalf of Bezos. And they concluded that they had, quote, medium to high confidence that MBS and the video he sent were responsible for the hack. The report they came up with was then reviewed by UN human rights experts who just this morning issued a statement saying they back FTI's conclusions. And they said that this hack was done in an effort to, quote, influence, if not silence, the Washington Post's reporting on Saudi Arabia. Here's Agnes Kalama. She's one of the UN experts that reviewed the report.
The allegation today places the Crown Prince at the heart of a campaign of hacking and intimidation against people perceived to be a threat to him and to Saudi Arabia.
Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist and prominent critic of the Saudi government, of course, who was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Lydia, how does he fit into all of this?
I actually spoke about this with Iyad al-Baghdadi. He was a friend of Jamal Khashoggi's, and he has actually been working directly with Bezos's team to investigate this hack. He told me that the timeline here is really significant. So Khashoggi starts writing for the Washington Post in 2017. Bezos then gets hacked in May 2018, and Khashoggi is killed in October 2018.
It seems that Mohammed bin Salman was further emboldened by the fact that he had compromising material on the owner of the Washington Post and the employer of Jamal Khashoggi, Jeff Bezos.
Last summer, al-Baghdadi was told that his phone had actually been targeted with spyware made by this Israeli company, NSO Group, and that the Saudis were using that software to spy on him.
Is the spyware made by the NSO Group the thing that was used to target Bezos' phone?
We don't know. The FTI report and the UN statement do mention NSO Group and the type of malware they make as an example of what might have been used. We did reach out to NSO and they denied any involvement here. But we do know that the spyware they make has been used by the Saudi government to target people. Anie Kalama, the UN expert I mentioned earlier, told me that regardless, the malware industry, it's really unregulated and really concerning.
We are facing a technology and an industry that is extremely difficult to regulate right now, that is not regulated, and that is extremely difficult to trace. Let that be a wake-up call.
And she told me that she hopes American officials investigate this.
The World's Lydia Manalidou, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The Saudi embassy tweeted a response to these allegations, calling them, quote, absurd. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The general strike in France appears to be winding down. It went on for 6 weeks, the longest strike in French history, and it disrupted daily life with transportation systems halted. But not everyone is calling it quits. Workers at a power plant outside of Paris shut off the electricity. Thousands of people lost power. It also affected Paris's Orly Airport and Rungis, the world's largest wholesale food market. Reporter Anita Elash tells me that a labor union is orchestrating these rogue strikes.
The CGT is the largest labor union in France. They represent mostly public sector workers, and they are also a far left, quite militant union led by an ex-communist with a very ostentatious handlebar mustache. And his name is Philippe Martinez.
So what is the reasoning behind the CGT for this action, the General Confederation of Labor?
Philippe Martinez has been out talking to people about this, and here's some of what he's been telling them.
Pour l'égalité, car on n'a pas à prendre des droits à ceux qui en ont.
And what's he saying?
Well, what he's saying is that it's a fight for social justice, it's a fight for equality, and that it's not about taking power from people who already have it, but that it's about giving power to people who don't have any at all. So as far as they're concerned, this is a question that's bigger even than pension reform. They're very much concerned that the president is taking what they see as an Anglo-Saxon view of the world, that Emmanuel Macron seems to be very sort of liberal politician. He is a former banker. And as far as the CGT and many people in France are concerned, he takes a very American view of the world.
So what then would be kind of the French vision, a system that would kind of conform more to what the French want?
The idea that everybody stands up for each other. They're concerned that Macron is trying to implement a system that would see everybody have to look after themselves. And that would mean down the road that their pension system would no longer exist. They're really worried that what Macron has in mind is a pension system similar to the system in the United States, where everybody basically has to fend for themselves.
Well, the six-week strike did manage to get some concessions out of the French government.
Yeah, I mean, the major concession really was that the government backed down on its threat, I guess, to increase the pension age from 62, or the legal age of retirement from 62 to 64. So for the time being, they've said they're not going to do that right away, that they'll do it progressively, and they'll try and introduce some kind of a change in a couple of years down the road.
Does it suggest the CGT is as powerful and influential as it's long been?
The CGT does have a lot of influence. You know, it's interesting that the French are not very heavily unionized. It's hard to believe, but the rate of union membership in France is one of the lowest in any developed country. But as you can see, unions like the CGT have a huge amount of influence. They've just shut down the country for 6 weeks. And, you know, and there's also really a history of this kind of thing. For years, French unions would take the boss hostage.
Right.
If they were having problems. And that was, I mean, technically, it's illegal to kidnap somebody in France. You can go to jail for a long time. But it wasn't until 2014 that any union members were actually charged with a criminal offense and sent to prison for kidnapping the boss.
There are the Yellow Vest protesters. How much crossover has there been between their movement and the general strike?
The Yellow Vest protesters have been at the general strike, but that has not really been the focus. In the last few days, though, there's a sense that the Yellow Vest protests are again picking up steam and maybe in some way picking up where the transportation unions are leaving off.
We will leave it there. Reporter Anita Elash in Paris, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco. It's good to talk to you.
In Iraq, at least 10 more protesters were killed this week. Some 450 have been killed since they began taking to the streets in October, demanding a new government and an end to corruption. The movement, as the BBC's Quentin Somerville reports from Baghdad, is led by young Iraqis.
It's quite something to chill on a beach in the middle of Baghdad, staring at the green zone and listening to rap. 16 years of American occupation only brought destruction. This country is controlled by Iran. We've had enough, is how the song goes. There's volleyball and shisha. It's a vacation space, a break from a country that Iraq's young protesters don't recognize as their own. This part of the Tigris was a forbidden space. Now, it almost feels like a party. But the protesters say their ambitions are much greater. They want to create their Iraq. They're tired of corruption, of sectarianism, of unemployment. And they've already had some success, but it's come at a terrible cost. But that, they say, won't stop them.
My name is Hamza Ali Mohammed and I'm 17 years old.
Hamza has been on Sinak Bridge above the beach for 40 days. You say that while you've been here, there have been kidnaps attempts and you've been intimidated. What kind of threats have you received?
I received 3 kidnaps attempts and I ran away. And I received a threat, an envelope with a bullet, and they're saying to me, be a good boy.
They've had enough of being patronised and enough of history. They never talk about Saddam Hussein or the Iran-Iraq war. And they've had it with their government's excuses. Almost 500 mostly young protesters have died at the hands of the security forces and Iranian-backed militia since these protests started in October. Iraq is a country with a personality disorder. It is Iran and it is America. Their influence and power affect politics, the economy and the military. I travelled to Al Asad Air Base in Anbar province, the latest site where the proxy war between Iran and America has burst into view. Al Asad Air Base is a great barometer of America's commitment to Iraq. The future of the Americans at Al Asad Base is under question because Iraq is so outraged at the breach of its sovereignty by the Americans attacking and killing Qasem Soleimani, Iran's leading general, who was a guest of Iraq on their soil. They now want the Americans to get out of Al-Assad and all their other bases here in Iraq. Back in Baghdad, the protesters want Iran and America to take their fight elsewhere. Damn them both, they chant. Abdullah Najjar is 25 years old. He too has been on the streets for months. With soaring unemployment, rampant cronyism, he has nowhere else to be.
Do you think the government's listening to you?
No, they are not listening.
So what do you do?
We are going to peacefully escalate. We haven't shot or killed anyone. The best we can do is burn those tyres, and this is a peaceful escalation that all countries can approve of. The state, the parties and the militias are all against us.
Back on Tahrir Beach, the mood has mellowed. The Iraqi national anthem is playing, they're singing and chanting. The old Iraq lies just across the Tigris. The green zone, its blast walls, monuments, embassies and government buildings. The sounds carry across the water, and those inside have no choice but to listen.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville reporting there from Baghdad. Nitrogen is a huge driver of climate change, and as farms try to control nitrogen pollution, they're looking at beer as part of the solution.
Kernza, it's a wonderful perennial wheatgrass that offers some really interesting agricultural attributes and flavor attributes as well.
I'm Marco Werman. Fertilizer, beer, and climate change still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The World Health Organization is weighing in on the outbreak of a new coronavirus that started in Asia. Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says the WHO is working with local experts in China to assess the outbreak.
The decision about whether or not to declare a public health emergency of international concern is one I take extremely seriously, and one I'm only prepared to make with appropriate consideration of all the evidence.
The emergency committee of the WHO will meet again tomorrow. So far, the virus has made more than 300 people sick. At least 17 people have died. The outbreak began last month in Wuhan, China. Other cases have popped up across Asia and elsewhere. One traveler to Wuhan tested positive for the virus here in the United States. Yanjong Huang is a senior fellow in global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. So we don't know whether this is going to be declared an international public health emergency. But if it is, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when we look at the criteria to satisfy that the public health emergency of international concern, what we called fake, that basically you have a problem that poses a risk to other countries. And secondly, in order to effectively address the outbreak, you need the WHO to coordinate the country's response.
So how extraordinary is a meeting like this? How often has an international health emergency been declared?
Well, so far we have about five public health emergency of international concerns being declared by the WHO, which include the 2009, the swine flu pandemic, the 2014, the polio outbreak, the 2014 Ebola outbreak in Western Africa, the 2016 Zika virus, and then 2018, the Ebola outbreak in Democratic Republic of Congo.
Had the protocol been set up in the 80s? Was HIV/AIDS declared a public health emergency of international concern?
I don't think so. This is essentially follow the protocol set by the International Health Regulation, which was revised in 2005 after the SARS outbreak.
This virus was first identified in a city in China at a fish market, but it's now getting all this international attention. Why is that?
Well, that is a good question. You know, that at that time, the assessment was that this is a relatively mild virus. It posed no serious threat to the society, given that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission, and there was one fatal case. You know, so the assessment was that this is not going to be as serious as SARS. But the beginning in January 20s, you know, that obviously the government updated its assessment, and it's now seems to be increasingly clear the virus has achieved human-to-human transmission, and also there's evidence seems to suggest that the virus is more virulent than it was thought.
This virus it falls into the category of coronaviruses, so the same family as the SARS virus that emerged in 2002 and killed nearly 800 people. At the time, China was criticized for being too secretive about that, but earlier we heard from a spokesman for the WHO in Geneva, Tariq Yasarevich, who said that scientists in China this time have been quick to develop and share details about the virus.
China was able in 9 days to sequence the virus and to share genetic sequence with WHO and with the world, which helped other countries to be able to identify this virus in those cases that they have reported.
Yanjiang Huang, what are you certain about with this virus right now, and what are the main unknowns?
There's still a lot of unknowns about the virus in terms of how virulent it is, how efficient it can be transmitted. But we know that the government, this is really on top of the agenda of the Chinese leaders, and now they seems to be ready to take decisive actions on that. You know, that is very evidenced in the recent, more recent decision to quarantine the entire city of Wuhan, a home with 11 million people.
Yanjiang Huang, a senior fellow in global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We know carbon dioxide is a big driver of climate change, but scientists say there's another type of pollution that's part of the story, nitrogen. Nitrogen pollution is rising fast. This fall, more than 200 scientists signed an open letter urging world leaders to act immediately. Today, we bring you a reporting collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative newsroom. Our focus is how nitrogen fertilizers are fueling climate change in the U.S. and abroad. Tomorrow, the story will take us to Ghana in West Africa, but we start today in Iowa at the height of the growing season a few months back. Here's Joe Wirtz, environment reporter from the Center for Public Integrity.
It's early summer near Rockville, Iowa, a town that bills itself as the Golden Buckle of the Corn Belt. Farmer Randy Souter is hoping his fields dry out so he can finally fertilize his crops.
Walking through that field out there this morning, I think, you know, 12 hours should give it enough time to dry, I hope.
Souter's fields were first soaked by late snows and then Iowa's record-breaking spring rain. He should have fertilized his corn weeks ago, but the mud kept him away. For farmers like Souter, nitrogen fertilizer is kind of the agricultural equivalent of magic pixie dust. Sprinkle it on and watch your crop yields grow.
You know, I started out with a 110 bushel yield, and I'm thinking it'll never get any better than this. Now we're pushing 300 bushel.
Commercial fertilizer was developed around the turn of the last century, and crop yields improved. But harvests really exploded when World War II munitions plants were transformed during peacetime into fertilizer factories. This promotional film from the National Plant Food Institute in the 1950s marvels at this new era of chemical agriculture.
From the skies above us, even from the air we breathe, these great manufacturing plants extract nitrogen and change it into usable forms for growing crops.
It's revolutionized farming and agriculture and really increased the yield.
Rona Thompson is a senior scientist at the Norwegian Institute for Air Research. She says fertilizer is necessary to feed a growing world population.
The flip side is, of course, the environmental consequences of using synthetic nitrogen fertilizers.
Those environmental consequences are big and growing. Some of them you might have heard of: fertilizer runoff that contaminates wells and feeds giant algae blooms. But there's another environmental side effect you might not know about. Fertilizer is also fueling climate change. Applying fertilizer to soil creates a chemical reaction that releases nitrous oxide into the air. Nitrous oxide is a greenhouse gas, 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide, and levels are up 70% since before industrialization. New research published this fall by Rona Thompson suggests those levels are climbing faster than we thought.
From about 2009, we see a marked acceleration in the emission of nitrous oxide compared to the previous, 10 years.
Thompson and other scientists say this is a growing and underappreciated climate threat, and agriculture is responsible for more than half of the problem. If something isn't done, nitrous oxide emissions could nearly double by 2050. That would likely mean more of the big rains that flooded fields in Iowa and throughout the Midwest.
We do want to turn now to the deadly and historic flooding in the Midwest.
Heavy rain continues to hit the Mississippi Valley.
The Missouri River is expected to crest today.
Davenport, Iowa, where a temporary levee failed.
Scientists say agriculture, like other modern industries, is suffering from some of the same climate problems it's helping worsen. In the U.S., fertilizer use on farms has escaped many of the federal regulations that apply to other polluting industries. And there's big pressure from farm groups to make sure oversight is based on voluntary recommendations, not rules. Many European countries have stricter regulations, and fertilizer use has dropped. But Thompson says farmers there still have productive fields and large harvests.
So they're using the fertilizer more sparingly, but in such a way that they are not diminishing yield.
U.S. and European markets for fertilizer are saturated, so analysts say companies eager to find new markets are setting their sights on other less developed countries where fertilizer use and crop yields are low. That means the nitrogen pollution problem is likely to get worse abroad. Here in the U.S., there are small efforts underway to tackle the problem. One solution is an age-old one. After the harvest, plant cover crops that soak up the nitrogen and decompose into a natural fertilizer. Right now, a lot of farmers don't grow cover crops because they cost money to plant and you can't sell them. But what if you could turn a cover crop into a cash crop? In southwest Minnesota, the small community of Edgerton is testing out this idea with a newly developed cover crop called Kernza.
So that's the Kernza right there.
Looks a lot like a grass. Well, they call it intermediate wheatgrass.
That's Doug Brands. He's the city's water manager. So why is he overseeing a local government farm? Well, this Kernza is growing in a field next to the city's main water well. For more than a decade, Edgerton has had problems with fertilizer byproducts called nitrates leaching off nearby farms and contaminating its wells.
We have really good drinking water in town, and we always have, but it's slightly elevated nitrates.
The city installed an expensive nitrate removal system, but Brands hopes they can use agriculture to help too.
Kernza has a gigantic rut, basically a nitrogen sponge is what I'll call it. So hopefully what is left of the nitrogen is getting absorbed by the Kernza, and as the water flows towards the well, it's been basically filtered.
General Mills helped create Kernza, and maybe more importantly, a commercial market for it, in restaurants and in products like Kernza pasta, pizza dough, and beers like the Longroot Pale Ale.
At Hopworks, we're really excited to be working with Patagonia Provisions on this new Kernza-based beer.
This Oregon brewery is happy to tout its connection to the nitrogen-absorbing grain in an ad.
Kernza, it's a wonderful perennial wheatgrass that offers some really interesting agricultural attributes.
Researchers say planting cover crops like Kernza will help, but it probably isn't enough to lower emissions of the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. Rona Thompson with the Norwegian Institute for Air Research says a bigger effect would come if people ate less of the products that come from and feed on high fertilizer crops like corn.
Not to say that everyone has to become vegetarian or vegan, not at all, but just eating less meat would be a start.
Eating less meat or enacting tougher fertilizer regulations. Either way, scientists say big changes to greenhouse gas emissions won't come without big changes from us. For The World, Joe Wirtz, Edgerton, Minnesota.
Tomorrow, our reporting collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity continues with a focus on farms in Africa.
We all know that agriculture is the key in the development of the continent.
You can read more about the connection between fertilizer and climate change at theworld.org. Sad news from the world of comedy. Monty Python legend and co-founder Terry Jones has died. He was born in Wales and as a comic actor, writer, and director kept us entertained across six decades. If you remember Monty Python, Terry Jones was best known, even among occasional viewers, for playing middle-aged women.
Spam, 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 even spam. Spam, 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 fake beans, spam, 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 and spam.
He expertly devised visual comedy in his sketches and later sharpened his directing skills in the films Life of Brian and The Meaning of Life. From the latter came his unforgettable character, the gluttonous Mr. Creosote, who concludes his massive dinner with a mint.
It's only a wafer thin.
Look, I couldn't eat another thing. I'm absolutely stuffed.
Just one.
Just one. Just the one.
If you only see the slapstick, though, you're missing the essence of Terry Jones as a comedian. He was the one who pressured the Monty Python gang to drop the idea of a punchline, to just let the sketch roll on stream of consciousness to the next sketch, even into the credits at the end of the show. When the idea was introduced, it left a lot of viewers scratching their heads, like the surreal glassblower sketch.
Well, of course, I used to break me own, but now you can get these at £24.50 a dozen. Well, why bother?
This is the first truly modern contribution to bottle design. A spontaneously fractured bottle that is immensely exciting and, I think, immensely relevant to our problems today.
Beyond comedy, Jones wrote books and produced TV documentaries on ancient and medieval history. He was even an expert on Chaucer and held a degree in history from Oxford, which is where he met Python pal Sir Michael Palin in a student comedy group. Today, Palin described Jones as, quote, far more than one of the funniest writer-performers of his generation. He was the complete Renaissance comedian, Palin said, the warmest, most wonderful company you could wish to have, which only added cruelty to Terry Jones' diagnosis of dementia in 2016. Jones was present at a British Film Academy ceremony shortly after. The damage was visible. Jones' son, Bill, walked him on stage to accept his award.
Button down. We'd just like to say thank you for everyone. It's, I know it's a great honour for Dad to win this award, and just the struggles we're having at the moment is a bit hard, but we're so proud of
him.
Thank you.
A sad moment, a sad passing, but Terry Jones left us so much to laugh about. Dozens of world leaders are gathering in Jerusalem. Tomorrow, they'll be marking 75 years since the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp. It's one of two global events commemorating the anniversary. The second will take place at Auschwitz in Poland. That will be on the actual date of the 1945 liberation of Auschwitz, January 27th. Tomorrow's commemoration in Israel has been overshadowed by a dispute between Poland and Russia, and Poland's president has decided not to attend the event. The World's Orla Barry is in southern Poland, where she's been asking about the controversy.
I'm in Krakow, Marco, which many people will know if they've been to Poland, is a beautiful old medieval city. But it's also just 1 hour from Auschwitz, the largest Nazi concentration camp where it's estimated that over 1 million people were killed, mostly Jewish, during the Second World War, many of them Polish. Around 90% of Poland's Jewish population was wiped out during the Holocaust. This is why marking the liberation of Auschwitz is so important for the people here in Poland, because it's so central to their lives.
Tomorrow's Holocaust commemoration event in Jerusalem is being overshadowed by this dispute with Poland. Tell us what the dispute is all about.
Indeed, the Polish president, he's refusing to attend. Now, if you are to listen to Israel and to the World Holocaust Center, Yad Vashem, who are one of the organizers of this event, the World Holocaust Forum, they will tell you that they have invited the four allied forces to speak. Have a listen. I spoke to Dr. Robert Rosette. He's a senior historian with Yad Vashem, and he explained the thinking behind not inviting Poland to speak.
The people who were invited to speak were, first of all, the four allied main powers, right, who were involved in the liberation of the Jews as the fighting forces, the Americans and the British and the French and what was then the Soviet Union, with Russia representing that. And the president of Germany is speaking for obvious reasons, right?
And Orla, what does Poland say is their understanding of why they weren't invited to speak, given that the event is all about Auschwitz, which is in Poland?
Yeah, Poland has a very different take on all of this. I met with the government MP yesterday, Radoslaw Fogiel, and he said basically this is all Russia's doing.
I would blame the link between the host, Mr. Moshe Kantor, and Vladimir Putin. Probably Mr. Kantor is just giving Mr. Putin a stage to be heard with this propaganda.
So Moshe Kantor, that he mentioned there, is the president of the European Jewish Congress, who are also very much involved in this event. But Moshe Kantor is himself Russian. He's a Russian Jew and is a good friend of Vladimir Putin's. So the line that you'll hear from Poland is that, in fact, this whole event has been organized with an eye to Russia, and that it's keeping Russian relations sweet. And in that sense, Poland has been excluded.
So there in Krakow, where you are, Orla, what have people been saying about this dispute between Moscow and Warsaw?
I expected, speaking to many of the Jewish community here, that they might be slightly critical of the Polish president, simply because they're not huge fans of the Polish government. It's quite a right-wing government and Catholic government, etc., and that they wouldn't be so supportive of them. But in fact, anyone that I've spoken to has been pretty much of the line that President Duda didn't really have a choice. For example, I spoke to one, he's very highly acclaimed historian here, Dariusz Stola, and I asked him what he thought about it.
I don't know what the intention is of Israeli policymakers. I only know that this is bad for the Holocaust commemoration. Poland should be there. And especially as in the past 30 years since the end of the communist regime, Poland has done a lot for Holocaust commemoration, for the commemoration of the Jewish history in general. It's indeed a pity that Poland is not represented there.
I also asked the chief rabbi of Poland, Michael Szudryk, about this. You might hear from his accent, he's not exactly originally from Poland.
Under the circumstances that exist, I think many people in the community understand why he didn't go. I don't see any kind of saying, oh my gosh, he didn't go. He's the president of the country. They're not letting him speak, although Auschwitz is here. Half the Jews murdered during the Shoah, the Holocaust, were from Poland. You can come to a different conclusion, but you certainly can understand his logic and thinking.
Orla, what are the reasons Israel might not want Poland and Jerusalem for this commemoration? Or should I say why Israel would not have a problem if President Duda of Poland is not there?
There has certainly been tensions between Poland and Israel over the last number of years. You might remember the Holocaust law that Poland introduced a couple of years ago, making it a criminal offence for someone in Poland or for anyone to say that Poland was complicit in Nazi war crimes. Israel was furious when this law was introduced because, well, it has been proven and historians have confirmed it, that there were those in Poland who were responsible for terrorism and the murder of Jews during the Second World War. And Israel took huge offence at the time when the law was introduced. The law has since been watered down somewhat, but it did cause some upset between both countries at the time. And also Israel is quite conscious of keeping relations smooth with Russia. So that's another angle to all of this.
The World's Orla Barry in Krakow, Poland, speaking with us about the dispute between Russia and Poland over the commemoration of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. Orla, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Let's get back briefly to the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump underway in the Senate. Under the new Senate rules, House impeachment managers and the president's team each have 3 days to make their arguments. Democratic managers got to work first today. Representative Adam Schiff started things off. He presented evidence on the two charges, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Schiff made a distinction. He said this impeachment process is different than a criminal trial.
Given the seriousness of the conduct at issue and its persistence, this matter cannot and must not be decided by the courts, which, apart from the presence of the Chief Justice here today, are given no role in impeachments in either the House or the Senate. Being drawn into litigation taking many months or years to complete would provide the president with an opportunity to continue his misconduct. He would remain secure in the knowledge that he may tie up the Congress in the courts indefinitely, as he has with Don McGahn, rendering the impeachment power effectively meaningless.
Don McGahn, who served as one of President Trump's White House lawyers. Looking ahead, Adam Schiff called on the senators in attendance to remember the oath of office they took.
There is, I think, no greater responsibility before you than the one before you now. The oath that you've taken to impartially weigh the facts and evidence requires serious and objective consideration. Decisions that are about country, not party, about the Constitution, not politics, about what is right and what is wrong.
Schiff talked about evidence pointing to President Trump's pressure campaign on Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and his son. Trump responded in real time on Twitter, "No pressure," he wrote, in all caps. That'll do it for us today. As your public radio station's coverage of the impeachment trial continues, you can always find The World in your podcast feed so you don't miss all the other things happening around the globe. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.